Okay, it is August 20th, 2014. It is 1:50 in the afternoon, and we are speaking with Lou Collier in the Soldovia Conference Center. My name is Jen Yeager, and this is a recording for the In Our Own Words project of Soldovia Village Tribe. Now, Lou, you were not born in Soldovia, is that right?
No.
Where were you born, and how did you come here?
I was born in Eastern Washington. And I came here shortly after high school in 48 on a salmon tender out of Seattle. Can I talk about a period that I am familiar with from, let's say, 48 to up to urban renewal, the earthquake, and perhaps maybe a little after?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, when I came here on a salmon tender out of Seattle as a cook, Soldovia at that time, and as the state of Alaska at that time, was a territory. We hadn't become a state until 59. So if I talk about a period, say, from 48 to 64, 65, well, when I arrived in Soldovia, there were four canneries here. There was Cook Inlet Packing Company, who had nine traps up the inlet, primarily from Humpy Point, just below the Nilchik. They were hand-set traps. At that time, they drove rebar when the tide was out into the beach and then tied small poles onto the creating a trap with webbing hanging in it. And we serviced that particular trap. That cannery was Cook Inlet Packing Company. And that was owned by a family. Estes's and Mason was the skipper of that boat. It was about an 80-footer. And we serviced all of those people up and down Cook Inlet, delivered into Soldovia. That was a small cannery, and then there was AYR, which was a larger cannery and primarily owned by outside Seattle interest. And then there was Alvilla cannery at the far end of town. That was a privately owned cannery. They had a tender. If I rattle on here, slow me down. Their tender was an old Second World War subchaser, AYR. They had also 210-foot subchasers from the Second World War. These were wooden boats. At that time, everything was wooden, fiberglass and all of that. Hadn't came about yet. And there was Soldovia Bay Packing Company, who I went to work for after statehood, because after statehood they outlawed all traps. There was a pile-driven trap at Anchor Point, and there was another one right over here on the other side of Holmes Lagoon. And we picked up salmon, run them into Soldovia. To say this was territorial days, no TV, no telephone. There was just a telegraph office here in Soldovia run by Lipke, who, as you doubtlessly know, Lipke Lane. I'm going to rattle on her. She used to chase me out of her building with a broom about the time urban renewal got started, and I was project manager on that. But it was an interesting time. You can ask me some questions here. I've met my wife here in Soldovia. She is a native, born and raised here in Soldovia. We've been married 60 years, just recently. The canneries at that time was all Filipino help. Each cannery had their own bunkhouse for Filipinos, Most of them run anywhere from 10 to 15 Filipino crews and local people also, but the Filipinos were the background or the backbone of the canneries. Everything was operated, the whole movement of employment was done by whistles. You went to work at whistles, lunch whistle, back to work whistles. So Lewis Bay Packing, well, they both had bunk houses and a mess hall. All the crews ate in the mess hall, and the canneries provided housing for the Filipino crew and whatnot. At that time, the cannery workers were getting paid about $2.36 an hour. No such thing as a coffee break. You worked the full 8 hours or however many hours was needed to process all the fish. That was all 1 pound cans. And of course, all the fish were supposed to be in the can within 24 hours, but that rarely ever happened. In fact, oftentimes you could see maggots laying on the table where the women were packing the. Sometimes you could get 2 to 3 humpies in a 1 pound can. We may have heard the expression, the iron chink. Mm-hmm. Well, that came from way back, even before the Filipinos. Originally, the labor in just about all of the canneries in the earlier days, even before I got here, was done by Chinamen. And at a later date, they invented a machine that they named the iron chink because it replaced so many Chinamen. It was quite a large cast iron machine that the fish came down the flue into this, and it arranged, you had to point the fish in the right direction, and a knife came down, chopped off the head, and it went on a little further, and it went up in a big interior wheel on the inside of this, probably 3.5 feet across circumference, and it held the fish with the open body up and a brush and lots of water. Scraped it all out and down around this wheel. They would go and then on to another cleaning table. It was quite a large table, but it probably 12 feet across, and it rotated. And all the women, they were called slimers. They finished dressing off the fish, cleaning them up a little bit. But this machine chopped off the heads and done the bulk of the cleaning. All of the heads, guts, and whatnot just went into the bay. At a later date, the canneries used scows with about 3-foot sideboards on them, and all the head and guts and whatnot went into the scow. But they often overflowed. They weren't very well tendered. And at the height of processing the bay out here, along the shoreline, you'd get about 6-8 inches of nothing but pink foam on it from the processing. We had a boardwalk, as you know, that run the full length of town. And the seagulls just had a ball. They would eat so much that they would literally stagger up and down the boardwalk or fall off the rail, literally. In the wintertime, discussing the boardwalk, in the wintertime, when the snow got deep, 2 or 3 feet deep, there was just a walking trail right down the center of the boardwalk. And of course, the dogs would turn the snow yellow, and the poop with the dogs and whatnot, it was pretty messy. At a later date, they came up with a fish processing plant making fertilizer, which had a horrible odor, just absolutely horrible. And it was 70, 80 pound bags, burlap bags, It was a rotating drum, probably 30 feet long, maybe, and about the size of a 500-gallon oil drum in height, in width. And it rotated. And it was a cooker at the same time that it rotated. And they would shovel all of this into this big cooker. And it would turn it into kind of a sawdusty consistency. And then we bagged it up. Well, and then at statehood, when the traps went out, the company that I worked for closed shop because all they had was traps. And a little later on, there was a shrimp processing plant that came to town that established themselves in one of the older buildings, warehouse. There was a Wint, was the name. It was a privately owned shrimp canning thing. We drug shrimp out here in Kachemak Bay, but there was such a large variety, and there was about 5 different varieties of shrimp. Coons, spots, pinks, that they had to devise a different method. They had at that time a shrimp peeling machine called a scrametta. There was another one that came at a later date called a peeler. But the one here used scramettas, and that was about 5 decks, each one of them on about an 18-degree angle. When I say decks, it was just one on top of the other. And the rate of flow of the shrimps going to it was regulated by water. More water, the faster the shrimp went. And each little bar, which went across each one of the platforms, had little hammers on it, little plastic hammers that looked very much like a hammer, but not with the claws and whatnot. And they went up and down and pounded on the shrimp to loosen up the shells on them. And as I say, if the shells were soft, depending upon the age, the shells would come off relatively easy. If not, you had to slow it down. And then there was a picking table that there was probably 10, 12 ladies standing on each side of it picking off the shells that didn't accompany them, didn't get all the way off. The man had an interesting... I run the Muskrata's machines for him for about a year. He only lasted about 3 years. They couldn't control a variety of things, the cost of doing the shrimp. In the process of trying to separate them out, they finally got a separator. But I run that thing, machine for him for a couple of years there, and he would have me come to work at 7:45. But I couldn't punch in till 8 o'clock. And I would run the machine getting there that early. So by the time the gals got there to pick off the shells at 8 o'clock, they were ready to go to work. They were already on the table. But he wouldn't let me shut off the machine until straight up noon. And the gals had to have the table all cleared off, which took them another 15 minutes. So he was gaining about 45 minutes a day of free labor. All the boats at that time anchored out in the middle of the bay. There was no breakwater. And you rowed ashore. And most of the skippers at that time, they would sit in the back of the skiff. And the crew member rowed the captain into the shore. We tied up all the skiffs underneath the boardwalk. And at that time, the bars went till there was nobody left sitting on a stool. So oftentimes the tide would come in and swamp the skiff because it was tied underneath the boardwalk. there was a good deal more natives at that time than what there are now by far, and they were treated pretty badly. You rarely ever hear the word Siwash anymore, but that was a pretty common word at that time. And that's interesting too, because we halfway used that word when I was in Korea, then in Gooks, of course. Anyway, I was here in 48 and 49, and then I went to Korea for 2 years, and I came back here in 53. Things were very much political at that time. Mr. English was the local magistrate, and if you wanted to get married, you had to see him, and when the baby was born, you had to see him, and when you died, you had to see him for a death certificate. If you wanted to get into the old folks' home, you had to go see him, which generally required that you turn over all of your property to him. I could probably tell you many things about the politics at that time. They haven't really changed a great deal now than what they were then, with the exception of now it's a number of people, while at that time it was only one person.
Well, I guess speaking of politics, one thing that I'm interested in, you know, you were, I think, on the city council right about the time that the Kenai Peninsula Borough was being formed, right? And then you were on the borough assembly.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what that was like in the early days of the borough and how Saldovia was represented there?
I was on the borough when it was first formed in 61 or 2, I can't remember which. The chairman was a man by the name of Harold Pomeroy. And at that time, it was a 9-member committee. And as I said, statehood in 59. And it took the state about a year there to figure out how to set up a borough. And of course, when we all got there to Kenai, we were meeting in Kenai. The question was just what the hell is a borough and what are we supposed to do? Because none of us knew. We were just local representatives. All of the books on a borough, there was 9 different books of directions that we later got. And then the first order of business was, how do we get money? Yeah. Everybody at that time swore up and down there would never be a personal property tax, which is, you know how that worked out. I sat on that for about 2 years, I guess, and at the same time representing Saldovia on the council. I served 3 terms on the council over a period of about 20-some years. That was interesting, talking about the borough. I got a phone call one evening from Mr. Pomeroy, and he said, Lou, that was right after the earthquake. He said, Lou, how would you like an urban renewal project in Saldovia? And of course I said, well, what the heck is that? Oh, he said, they come and tear down your houses and rebuild them. He says, you want me to send some people down? And I said, sure. So here they come. That was the beginning of that. You hear many things about urban renewal and what happened and what didn't happen. And I was project manager on that for 6 years. And the way that occurred, we had to have a vote to see whether we wanted urban renewal or not. Of course, at that time, the town was flooding. The boardwalk was flooding. And as you know, it was all hand-set piling. None of it was driven. So every time the tide had come in, the boardwalk would kind of float. We wound up putting a little over 4,000 sandbags on the boardwalk, in addition to quite a few in a couple of the warehouses to keep them from floating away, because they weren't, again, they weren't pile driven, they were just set piling, dug in by hand. Yeah, I lost my train of thought there for a minute.
I think you were talking about the election in
terms
of whether to have a renewal.
Whether we would have it or not. So the city come up with a plan of, had a yes column and a no column. Headed up with, shall we have an urban renewal project? If you wanted it, you signed in the yes column, and if you didn't, you signed in the no column. This was kept in City Hall. So this was quite a lengthy process. Problem with that is you'd go down the street having written either yes or no and talk to one of your friends or something. They may change your mind, so you'd go back down to City Hall and change your name from the no column to the yes column, or vice versa, whichever the case may be. So that didn't work very well. So we decided to have a secret ballot, which we had, and the city clerk counted them ballots in the city offices, and it came out about 2-1 in favor of having an urban renewal project. Well, the opposition cried foul. It was rigged. So we had another election, and this time all the ballots were dumped out on the council chamber's table. And they were counted right there in front of the audience. And it was quite a large turnout, as you can imagine. And it still came out about 2-1. So that was the way it went.
And when they came in and initially proposed the urban renewal project to the council and to the city, did they give you a good explanation of what that was going to be?
Oh, no. Well, no, like any bureaucratic programs, they always just paint the good part of it. You know, the expression is the devil is in the details. So it wasn't a case of them coming in and tearing everything down and rebuilding it. That wasn't the way it worked. The contractor that bid on it, it was a federal project. The contractor that bid on it, and it was accepted by the Alaska State Housing Authority, who I later went to work for, it was accepted by then. He basically, technically owned all of the buildings in town.
The contractor did.
Yeah, the contractor did. And it was his right to dispose of them in any way that he wanted to, because he was responsible for removing all of them and putting all this fill in, which is roughly 310 feet. At its widest point, is all fill. Basically, all of the property belonged to him. I had to set up, that was kind of hard to take, I had to set up a rent program, because that's the way those project works. People who owned their homes and owned their building all of a sudden found themselves in position of paying rent on them. That rent money was funneled back into the project to help pay for it. But the real problem come in rebuilding the town, because some of these buildings here were up to 80 years of age. They still had the old-fashioned black single-strand electrical wiring in them through the little white porcelain insulators. they were that old, so the people basically, the bank wouldn't lend them any darn money on it, because at that time they wouldn't meet codes. We had to adopt plumbing codes, electrical codes, and all of that. Well, it was automatic, really. The minute we accepted the urban renewal money, we also accepted the uniform building code and everything that went with it. Well, here's all of these old buildings that are subject to flooding. Still had this old wiring in it. Still had plumbing that was whatever you had. So the banks wouldn't lend them any money on it. So that basically pretty well meant removal, which it was. About one of the only buildings that within the project area is that one that Chuck Gillick lived in over here. Frankie Sarikoff's old place. And the only reason that got saved was because I made it a point to... it at that time was the only concrete foundation in the entire town. It was in the project, but I managed to get it cut out of the project just for that reason. The value of that, of the houses within the area, the Housing Authority did two separate, distinct appraisals of them. If you didn't like the appraisal, you could get your own appraisal. And then it was negotiated between either the two or the three. Sometimes it worked out where you got what you wanted, sometimes it didn't. But at that time, you got to consider just what is the value of a piece of property or a home that floods every time the tide comes in. What is its value? How do you determine that? Particularly when it's going to be torn down. So it's, you know, but still, it's about impossible to put a value on it. We tried to, we got a hold of the Salvation Army and asked them if they'd help us on a local level. And they sent us 20 screw jacks. I don't know if you know what a screw jack is, but it's about that tall. And you crank it around and around and it raises things. Well, obviously with the building sitting underneath, or sitting on the beach, particularly at that end of town, and it was all sand. So when you attempted to jack up the building, the timbers that the house was sitting on were so rotten that the screw jack just went right on through them. So we couldn't jack them up. But on some that we tried, Hank West, Cleo's ex-husband, had a little sawmill out of town. The Salvation Army came up with $8,000 for him to cut timbers and whatnot to help jack up some of these buildings. But as I say, that didn't work because most of them were so rotten sitting on the beach that you couldn't jack them up. About the highest priced house down in that end of town was $6,500. But you got to keep in mind too, at that time, you could buy a bad lot in Soloe for $25. And you could buy a damn good one for $100, a lot, at that time. So anyway, that was about the story of it. As far as the urban renewal thing was concerned, they started at that end of town. And that's why if you look at the map, it's, what do they got at, 1, 2, and 3. It's divided into three sections, subdivision 1, 2, and 3, I think it is. We started at that end of town. We cut down Caps Hill over here, which is over there where Mike Miller lives. As I recall, we got 98,000 cubic yards of material out of there. Leveled that all off. That was all And I can't recall what we got out of Giles's property down here in the boatyard to do all of the fill and whatnot. Vivian's house up there on the hill, that was right about down in here someplace. It had just recently been built within a couple of years before the earthquake. I tried to buy that from the contractor. We had made a deal on it. I owned all, well, I didn't own all of it, but I owned 4 lots where the school presently sits. And I wanted to move it up there. But the roads were so narrow, I couldn't move it up there. So I was going to pay $4,000 for it, which was a lot of money at that time. Somehow or other, it got moved down to the other end of town when I discovered I couldn't do anything with it. I had 4 foundations for cabins up there where the school sits. The borough decided, and the city decided, they wanted to build a new school. So there was about 4 people involved in the property that the borough wanted for the school. Harold Youth, Gladys's husband, Frank Raby, myself, and 1 other individual. I can't remember who that was. Anyway, they had all signed to let the borough have their property. And I had just gotten those 4 lots that I had there where part of the school sits. And I had 4 concrete foundations on them for cabins. So I refused to sell. So it got to the point where just about everybody in town just really disliked me. So, of course, they threatened to condemn me, which they would have, and I didn't have the money at the time to go through all that expense, get a lawyer and all that kind of good stuff. So I said, okay. And for 4 lots where that school sits, that was a nice sloping ground with a southern exposure. It was a great place for even a home. I got the grand total of $3,500 for 4 lots. So, and then, of course, I met my wife. I think we got married in, I don't know, you can do the math. We just got done having a 60th wedding anniversary. She worked in a little restaurant. You may have heard the comments of Keep a Go. There was a little Greek guy in there. Louis was his name. He ran the restaurant. My wife worked there. And I got acquainted with her in there. You could go from the bar into the restaurant. Oh, there's another interesting thing on urban renewal. At the time of we decided as the bar was the prime location of everybody in town, and we were about to tear everything down. We got a waiver from the feds to use part of the urban renewal money to build a community building. So we built one about where the store is. It was 60 feet wide by 120 feet long. a steel building. And we had the Polar Bar, the Linwood Bar, the liquor store, the post office, and a restaurant, all within that building. And it was really great because you could just go from one bar to the next without even going outside. The post office was in the front of the building, just a small area. And then there was a restaurant. And down the middle was a hallway, and the bars were on both sides of the hallway. And if you didn't like the company in one bar, you could just walk over to the next one.
And where did you say that building was?
Oh, let's see. I don't know. Somewhere's right around in here. Even when I look around today, I have somewhat of a hard time of, you know, good grief, this was 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So that was the post office kind of in between the original one that Adam Block built?
Oh, no. That was further downtown here, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because Adam Block was the post office until urban renewal, right?
Yeah, oh, God.
It's an old building.
That was a three-generation, show you how politics work. There was a three-generation family-run post office, from Adam to Susan to Bob Gruber's wife to... that you see a picture of that post office with a bicycle and a little kid on? That's my wife and Raymond, her brother. That post office, when they tore it down, the logs were just absolutely sawdust. There was about 20-some cats that come out of that building. You went down there to pick up your mail, you know, and you kind of walked downhill into an Arctic entryway. And it stunk so bad of cat pee, you just would not believe it. You couldn't get out of there quick enough. Jesus. It was really terrible. Yeah. Jack was the wheeler and dealer of Soldovia at that time, as a territory. And him and I, we were constantly locking horns over urban renewal. Jack had six properties that he had been the executor of for many years. Fact of the matter is the house that my wife and I finally bought over across the slough, partial logs, that he had been executor of for many, many years. One of them was up to 26 years that he had never settled it. Jack had been collecting the rent off of all those houses, unbeknownst to the heirs of the estate. That was one of the reasons why he fought urban renewal so bitterly, because he was about to lose his income. He was a genuine thief. But he was a clever politician. Christmas time, there was always bags of oranges or apples or maybe even a small turkey for the needy folks. At that time, you could solicit votes coming out of the bar. In fact, that was quite prevalent. The bars could stay open at that time. Didn't have to close on election day. There was always a fair amount of money passing back and forth between Jack and whoever was going on. But that was in territorial days. It's when Gruning was still the representative for the territory of Alaska. Later on, it was Ralph Rivers. I met him once in the Westward Hotel, which is now the Hilton, when I worked for the state. I introduced myself, told him I was from Soldovia. And just right off the top of his head, he said, my only contact in Soldovia is with Jack English. End of conversation. But as I say, Jack and I were friendly adversaries. I used to go down and visit him when he lived in that little house there, which is another story in itself of how he managed to steal that from the Elks. But I used to go down and visit him. He had what he called File 13. That was where he kept his Canadian club. Yeah, he always had telegrams just scattered all over the table, you know. And I always had, there were so many of them that I just had the feeling that they were just telegram envelopes that he had gathered up to show his importance, because they were just littered on the table. Well, anyway, there's many other things I could tell you if I could think about them.
So one question that I've had is, you know, the average lot size in Seldovia is quite small. And certainly in the boardwalk days when everything was on pilings, there's no need for a yard, so why would you need a big lot, I'm assuming. And so I've always wondered, is the current small lot size in the downtown area, is that kind of a relic of the pre-urban renewal times, or is that just a coincidence?
Most of the area here, really the lots are about the same size as they were prior to it. They just straightened them out a little bit, which was a horrible mistake in my view. At that time, the Alaska State Housing Authority had a planning department head by the name of Lydia Selkrag, who was also, both her and her daughter, at a later years, remain head of the planning department for the city of Anchorage. She was a little Italian gal, spoke pretty broken English. She was really a geologist. She wasn't a planner. And she had the idea of a European-style community down there where the clinic and the fire station are. That was quite a big area, quite a big lot. And on both sides of the street, primarily on that side where Hopkins lived, her concept was a European-style community with the core of the township right there in all the little shops around it, like some European village, was her concept. That's why they were as small as what they are, which upset me very badly at the time. Lydia came to me one day and handed me a plat of Seldovia, this area, with a box of colored crayons, colored pencils. And she said, "Lou, zone Seldovia." And I said, "Okay." So I colored in those areas that I thought was residential and what I thought was commercial. And without bragging, they're still the same today as what they are then. Only the definitions have been changed. That has always been Seldovia's problem, in my view. The community is so small that the moment that you step out of line, and when I say step out of line, I don't really mean it in that sense, but the minute you suggest something that upsets the area in general, immediately become a bad guy. That's one of the reasons why so little is ever done here. You think about it. You know, I drive up and down the Kenai Peninsula. And in 60 years, when I came here, the road from Anchorage to Seldovia was about 50% gravel. Wasn't paved. And now I drive up and down the area from Homer to Anchorage, and I see the accomplishments that Homer has done. I see the accomplishments that Soldotna has done, what Kenai has done, and I look at Soldovia, and it just about makes me cry. Do you know there hasn't been any asphalt laid in Soldovia, with the exception of that where they dug up there, in better than 45 years? We're still bouncing over the same potholes that we were 45 years ago. And I wonder why. You think about it. The city of Soldovia has been operating on grants. God knows when. Everything that is done in Soldovia in the way of water and sewer, any improvement, is on grants. I ask myself, what the hell is happening to the taxpayers' money? Where's it going? I can see where it's going. It's going at City Hall. When all of this, you know, Elaine used to be the clerk, the treasurer, and the whole ball of wax. That was when the population was 450 people. Now it's less than 350 or 250, or right in that area. But yet now we've got, what do we got? One, two, three. We got three people in City Hall plus the city manager. Everything that is accomplished around here is done with grants. And if it's not done with grants, basically the city turns around and hires Hopkins. So ask yourself, where's your money going? And how come the potholes aren't leveled off when they need to be, not when somebody is convenient for them to do it? So as far as I'm concerned, the city's really getting shafted, has been for years. For years. And to me, it just really upsets me. Part of the reason is, shortly after, we were stuck with urban renewal planning and zoning for 30 years. That was the way the law was written. That expired, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, maybe more. I've forgotten. Along with the dock. Asha built the damn dock down here, not the city. Through a bond issue. That was the first sales tax we ever had, 1%. It was for that dock. Under those conditions, that 1% was supposed to have expired. When those bonds were paid off. That 1% is still there. There's not enough people around that remember that. And as time went on, the city and the Planning and Zoning Commission has watered down the building permits so drastically. And if you know the right person, it doesn't make a hell of a lot of difference anyway. You know, I see it every day. You can't build two structures, residential structures, on one lot. I see it down there with a helicopter guy. I see it down there with Pearly. They've cut back the setback so drastically. If they ever had a fire down there on Shoreline Drive, the whole damn place would probably burn down. It's a hazard. I suppose you could say part of the reason is the lots are so small that the setbacks are difficult to handle. But then on the other hand, the Planning and Zoning Commission, as the ordinance requires, could say to the potential builder, hey, you got to build something smaller. But no, they don't say that. They either give him a conditional use or a variance. So anyway. So
urban renewal started in 1965?
Well, we actually didn't really get going until about 1966. Mm-hmm. Then it was a six-year program. Mm-hmm. But they didn't, everything shut down in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. So it was just for that short period of time. All the contractor, Studnick, he bunked his crew up in the old Soldovia Lodge that Freddie Neumeyer used to own. And prior to that, they really built a nice bar. Jackie Purcell's grandfather was the original developer of that property. And he built a hell of a nice bar, nice cocktail bar, nice restaurant. And it burned down New Year's Eve before it ever opened. And then we got Neumeier. Oh, and then the store there where the liquor store is had a little bar in it run by Chuck Knight where you could cook your own steak. Frank got that at a later date.
So you said urban renewal was a 6-year program, so that what was all encompassed in that was that, you know, I know that, you know, buildings were removed and that the fill was created and put in place. What was considered kind of the final stage of urban renewal for the project itself?
Well, really, it just kind of faded away when the contractor got done. The contractor put in all the water and sewer, put in all the streets, wasn't done by the city. And when he got done with the project, we were stuck with the planning and zoning part of it. We couldn't change that up until that 30-year period ended. But that really wasn't paid any attention to. When the contractor got done and the city signed off on it, was really, it was about the time the contractor got done, the city signed off on it, and then they were responsible for it. But as a small community and everybody trying to get along, it just kind of went by the wayside.
Did the community get any say in, say, the layout of the streets and that type of thing, or how did that plan?
Oh, yeah, we had that was the first comprehensive plan. We were required to come up with a comprehensive plan, which the city wanted no part of, and the Housing Authority, Alaska State Housing Authority, primarily developed the plan, which was, I'm really disappointed. It's amazing to me how things rarely change. You go down and read that comprehensive plan that's pinned up on the wall, and there's so much BS in it that isn't that way and won't be that way, that it to me is pathetic, absolutely pathetic. I was involved in comprehensive plan, and I was involved in the planning and zoning, and that thing there is probably the worst one I've ever seen.
The current one?
Yeah, the current one. It's just a guideline, but in reality, in my view, the Central Business District is primarily owned by the city of Soldovia. You look down the street down there by the harbor, and all of that from that so-called pavilion clear up to the bus shop is owned by the city. That's the primary development property in Soldovia. The boat harbor, or the boat storage area, is also owned by the city. Well, all of that area down there is free parking to the tourist for 3.5 months out of the year. So when the city talks about growth and development, they're kidding themselves. How can you have growth and development when the city owns all of the damn property within the business district and it's free parking? Okay, then you might say to me, well, geez, Lou, what would happen? We need the harbor. Obviously, we do. The harbor is not only an asset, but it's a liability just for that reason. I say, let them, you'll notice as quick as the tourist season is done with, all those cars will go back out to the airport. That's where most of them stay. That's where most of them are parked. So the city maintains that whole area for free parking that does nothing, for economic development. The storage area here, I think they charge an extra $5 for somebody to put their boat in there. The city is not responsible, in my view. Them same boats that are normally down there in the harbor could remain down there in the harbor in the wintertime. That property would become available for development. Besides, they might hire two or three guys to shovel snow off of them boats to create a little bit of income for the local people. So it just seems to me that when the city likes to talk about growth and development, they're kidding themselves. Because where do you get the growth and development when the city owns all the developable property? Can't get it. And sooner or later, the city is going to be forced to admit they're going to have to raise the sale taxes. Most particularly when Michelle's building ever gets done, if it does. Because there's no way in God's world he's going to be able to eat that thing. As you may know, the store there cost SNA about $60,000 a year just to heat it. Michelle's going to have serious problems. The city's going to have to just about give it to him like they gave Buck Blodgett. Same thing. Same situation. So it really saddens me to see what could have been a hell of a nice community if they hadn't watered down the building codes and maintained that property that is only active 3.5 months out of the year, and the city don't get a dime off of it. You may say, well, yeah, the tourists who come to Soldovia create, you know, you sell a few beers and a few sandwiches in the local buildings, but it's not doing the community, the people who live here, any real good. It's not.
So what was the process, you know, when all the people whose properties were along in the project area, and those were all bought out. So what was the process for kind of reprivatizing this area?
The process was those people that were displaced by the Urban Renewal Project had priority on rebuilding on whatever location they wanted to on lots that were created along the waterfront. They had first priority. That required a building permit, of course, at that time. And I don't mean a pencil-drawn sketch. Like any large city or any city, you had to have an architectural plan. You had to show the electrical, plumbing, all of that, the mechanics. The city watered that down. Then, of course, now I think it's $5 you can get a builder permit in Soldovia to build a $1 million house. Well, in Anchorage, you'd be paying about 10% of the cost of that development. Or in Homer. So there again. Anyway, the process to answer your question was the people who were displaced could buy those lots back. I might add, those lots at that time sold for about $1.25 a square foot. And the improvements to those lots were about $3.50 a square foot. The water and sewer, the stub outs, they all had stub outs. Mm-hmm. So really it was an ideal situation. But about at that time, the king crab really got going. When we started fishing king crab in Kachemak Bay was about 53. By the time 64 rolled around, and prior to that, Kodiak had 26 canneries at one time. I think they're down to about three now, three or four. The king crab effort moved to Kodiak. Josie left Carl Olson, he left. Not to mention, it was a combination of both, because we were buying their houses.
That Jose Carlo?
Yeah. So there was quite an exodus at that time, brought on primarily by the big push for crab and what happened here in urban renewal. If your house is getting torn down, what are you going to do? So it was kind of a combination of both. And then you got to stop to consider, too, at that time, here come the borough. And a borough tax. You know, there's just all kinds of things happening within that 5 or 6 year period of time. The cannery, AYR, kept giving the Alaska State Housing Authority a bad time in the sense that we can't build in Soldovia because they have no dock, no way to get our product out. Of course, they'd been getting it out before. But they kept coming up with all kinds of excuses of why they couldn't do anything. We later found that they were moving to Port Graham, unbeknownst to us. And they were getting a, what they called a self-move that I managed, where you could move yourself and get paid to do it. Hell of a good deal. Wakefield, that was interesting with Wakefield. They got a loan for $750,000 that originally built the original Wakefield plant. You were probably here when that was going, weren't you?
Towards the end, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the original. Bought down there now where the supposed fish plant is going to be. He got a loan, SBS loan, for $750,000 to build that. And then the housing authority found out he was going to build in Port Lions. No taxes, no wharfage. So the housing authority told him, hey, in small business, you either build in Soldovia or you don't get no loan. Or that cannery wouldn't have been here. So he was forced to build here, which is another interesting story. I had an office down at the far end of town, owned by Carl Nordenson, Bruce's dad. And I got a call one day, and the boss says, Lou, I'm going to send some people down to you, and I want you to lease a boat. I said, okay. So later on that morning, here come an admiral, two senators. I don't know. There was about a half a dozen of them anyway. And I leased, I don't know if you ever recall, the old John Adams. It was owned by Sam, not Sam Selbog, but, oh well, whatever the case may be. And they come into the office. There was half a dozen of them or more. Wanted to know if I got the boat. So they're all looking at maps and whatnot, and pretty quick I hear, we're going to move Soldovia to Port Graham. It'd be too costly to do all of this fill and whatnot. I said, oh, wait a minute. I said, that's not going to... At that time, Port Graham and Soldovia were pretty much adversaries, just as Homer and Soldovia was. I said, whoa, that's not going to go over very well with the people of Soldovia, what was left of them. The big discussion ensued from that. And about that time, fortunately, the wind come up and it just turned the bay here and nothing but white caps. All of these folks weren't quite used to that weather, so they canceled out and flew back to Anchorage, with a pilot called Lucky Pierre. During that period of time, there was about 6 airplane crashes going on. So anyway, they flew back to Anchorage, and that pretty well ended that discussion, but that was the plan. Oh, and then they were also going to sink 3 Liberty ships out here across the mouth of the bay. So the swell coming in wouldn't tear up the boardwalk. In the meantime, prior to all this redevelopment and tearing the town down and whatnot, that's where the Admiral come in. And they finally decided, well, that might be a little costly and it wouldn't do a hell of a lot of good. There wasn't that much swell, and besides, the tide wouldn't do much for keeping the tide down. So it was really comical. They didn't have the faintest idea about a tide. None of them. Talk about a tide or raising 24 feet or whatever, you know. And it just didn't register. They were people from New York City and New Mexico. I think a couple senators, one from New Mexico, and I don't know where the hell the other one was. But it was... So besides, they'd have to send divers down and prepare the bottom to sink these Liberty... You know what a Liberty ship is? Yeah, they were ships that they used in the Second World War for moving trips. In fact, I went to Korea on one. Anyway, that's my story. There's lots of other little incidents. I don't know. I really like Soldovia, but I'm certainly